Today's Taisho will be on case 3 in the Pien Lu, the Hikigan Roku. That case is entitled Basso's Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. Engo's introduction. Each key and every kyo, every word and phrase is a means for the moment of leading students to realization. But every such manipulation is like performing an operation on a healthy body and will give rise to complication upon complication. The great way manifests itself naturally. It is limited by no fixed rules. But I must tell you that there is an advanced theme that you will have to learn. It presides over heaven and earth. However, if you try to guess at it, you will be confused. This can be right, and that can also be right. It is so delicate. This cannot be right, and that also cannot be right. An unapproachable cliff face. How could you manage without stumbling here or there? Study the following. The great master Basso, Matsu, was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. He asked, "How do you feel these days?" The master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Setro's verse, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha," compared with them, how pale the three sacred sovereigns, the five ancestral emperors. For 20 years, I have had fierce struggles descending into the dragon's cave for you. The hardship defies description. You clear-eyed monks don't make light of it. So much for coming to sit this morning on this beautiful spring day. We were lucky enough to do kinhin outside, and I think that's a wonderful practice. It's not always possible to do kinhin outside because there's so much going on, but the school semester is over, and not too many people were out there. You know, we've been sitting here since early morning, and we get up and go out of the building and walk around that little circle, and all the plants are alive now and in flower or about to be in flower. And all the leaves have come out and they're green. And it's like heaven on earth. It's not easy to get to that place. You know, I don't know if you got to that place today, but it's not always easy. You know, for me this morning, it was really like heaven on earth, you know. Walking outside, you even feeling the ground under your feet is so deeply welcoming. The feeling of the ground under your feet, it's not just reassuring, it's life itself. And then to take a step and another step mindfully, and you hear the birds singing, the clouds overhead, and wind, slight breeze blowing in the leaves. You know, the boundary between yourself and the world has diminished a little bit or dropped away. And so when you we leave the zendo and we go outside and we walk that circle, You can just feel the sunlight on your skin. Now, this room is a little cool, but not as cool as the rest of the building. And you might have been a little cold in here this morning, but when you walk out, and we walked out, and you feel that heat, the radiant heat on your flesh, it's so delicious. It's so delicious. Just taking a step, just smelling the air, feeling the sun on your face. Now, if you talk to somebody later on in the day and say, what did you do this morning? You say, I felt the sun on my face. That was amazing. They wouldn't probably understand what you were talking about. You know, because people are so distracted. They're so caught up in the 10,000 things. It's sometimes called the red dust, of this life, right? You know, we all do it. You know, my wife, her sister, is coming to stay with us, and she is preparing for her sister's arrival, while I'm preparing to leave for Sashin on Sunday night. So we each have our lists, right? I came in last night from the sit here, and I went into the kitchen, and I noticed on the table that holds the dishes, you know, on the sideboard, there was a list that my wife had made of all the things she has to do before her sister Chris comes. And upstairs on my desk, I have a list of all the things that I have to do to get ready for Sashin. And it's just like running. You know, yesterday, I had to take my car in before Sashin. I wanted to. I've been so busy, I haven't had a chance to take my car in. So I took my car into my automotive place, which is in Edison, right on the edge of Highland Park, and I dropped it off, and I put my bicycle in the back, and I rode my bicycle to work, and then I got a call around 4:15 saying, your car's done, we've changed the oil, we've done the tune-up and everything, and I got on my bicycle, and I started riding, and the tire, the rear tire was flat, so now I have to take my bicycle into the shop. So, you know, I had to race up there, and I was just single-mindedly focused on getting to GT Automotive before it closed at 5:30, because I need the car to go to Sashin, you know. And I have to be honest with you, I didn't notice anything on the way. You know, I was just, I had that image of GT in my mind and the desk, and Julie behind the desk, and I was constantly returning to that image as I'm racing up Woodbridge Avenue, it's easy to become single-minded in a bad way, you know, and so caught up in our purposes that we can't slow down and experience what we did today. So, you know, today is so therapeutic, right? Coming in the evening and sitting for an hour is wonderful, but sitting for, you know, five periods is really, really purifying. You know, coming in and sitting down on the cushion, doing three, then having a break, doing two more, and then when we get up and we go outside, and you can feel, you hear the wind. You know, your mind is kind of empty, or emptier than when you came in. And there's a less of a sense of separation from the things around you. And this is really priceless. It's not just a cool experience. It's not just an aesthetic event, right? I mean, if you think about it, all of our problems, all of them, are caused by our sense of separation from the things around us, the people and the things around us. If you are a follower of environmental news, you know that there are many problems in the world that people aren't addressing. And I like to be outdoors. I've spent a significant amount of time, especially when I was younger, hiking, especially out west. I'm always struck by how many people who are sort of like anti-environmentalists come from out west. And having spent a lot of time in the West, I'm always amazed at how people can grow up in a place like Montana or Wyoming or New Mexico and not be sort of sensitive to the value of the natural world, you know. But I think part of it is that people who live out there just don't pay attention. You know, it's a funny thing, but I think when they look at a mountain, they think about what they can do with the mountain. And when I look at the mountain, I think about how wonderful it would be to disappear into that mountain. I don't just mean put on my hiking boots and hike up into the mountain. I mean disappear into the mountain, to become one with the mountain, to become one with the sun on my face, to become one with the breeze in the trees. This is the practice of Zen. And it's possible to think about what we're doing as, you know, relatively trivial. But I think what brings people back to the cushion is this experience of getting beyond the boundaries of the self. And when you get beyond the boundaries of yourself and you become one with the world around you, it has this profoundly transformative effect. This is especially true if you've been sitting for a long time. You know, so for example, we're about to go off to a sesshin, meditation retreat. And, first few days, people become more self-absorbed, interestingly. You know, so on the first day of sesshin, you're just meditating. And by the end of the day, it's becoming a little difficult. By the second day of sesshin, generally speaking, your legs hurt and maybe you're tired. And those conditions make people more actually like introverted, right? More sort of self-referential. But what happens around the third day of sesshin is what can happen in a less dramatic way here on a Saturday. You know, when we sit for five periods, we go outside. That boundary between the self and the world drops away, and then everything seems alive, or everything we become aware of how alive everything is. Anybody who has meditated for many days on end has had this experience of sort of walking outside and just sort of being stunned by the life energy circulating around you, this sense of connection to things and the vibrant life of things. And when this happens, you know, we become very happy. You know, this is sort of like getting in touch with reality. You know, there are definitely people on Earth who believe that trees have spirits and so on. Trees have spirits. And you know, modern people laugh at that. But I think what those ancient people were saying is that they were able to access this consciousness where the sense of separation disappeared, and they felt keenly, you know, the aliveness of everything around them. And this is really like, in my opinion, arrival. This is like arrival at reality, at sanity. You know, and it has the profound, the more you go to that place, the deeper you can enter that state, and the longer it lasts, you know. And it's not just the natural world, you know. I've talked about this before, but I remember coming back from a session with my teacher, Webb Roshi, and he went into like a 7-Eleven or something, and I was sitting in the car, and while I was waiting for him, I turned on the radio, and these pop tunes were coming off the radio, and I felt like I was going to sob. They were so beautiful. You know, it's possible to say that that's sort of a distorted perception. They're just these pop tunes. But actually, I think our ordinary consciousness is distorted. You know, so much of the way we live is based upon this very profound sense of separation from the things around us and from the people around us. And we see that all over the world right now. People are, I think, for various reasons, withdrawing into themselves as individuals and as collectivities. And the more you do that, the more menacing the world becomes, the more frightening the world becomes. You know, that state of consciousness in Buddhism we call samsara, samsara. That's like maximum sense of separation from everything around me. And people retreat generally into that state when they're afraid, or they spend a lot of time there because fears in the past have made it their baseline. They've been habituated to this very strong sense of separation from the world around them. And in that state, people will do some bad things and some terrible things. People become very narcissistic. They become very self-absorbed, very insensitive to others, and so on. You know, so what we've done here today is really like repairing the world. But the world doesn't really need to be repaired. We ourselves are a little bit broken. That is to say, we have fallen into mental habit, the mental habit of separateness. And in fact, you know, some people live their whole lives there, or most of their lives there. It's only natural for people to get out of that state sometimes. So, you know, one of the reasons people like, say, alcohol is that it actually does break down that barrier a little bit. And I think people who get, who use some drugs also feel this tremendous sense of release when they use these drugs, because that sense of a barrier or separateness makes us feel safe. But it also causes us a lot of suffering. We're really suffering. You're safe, but you're locked in yourself. And so I think people are sort of like crying out to get out, right? And so, you know, basically, Zazen, meditation, Chan, is really one way to overcome that mental habit of separation and begin to participate in the bigger life to which we all belong. It's regrettable that our society has not valued this or given people, made this an important element of, say, education. You know. I'm not criticizing anybody, but I go into my classroom and I'm a person of another generation. When I come into my classroom, I'm 40 years older than the students in the room, possibly 45 years older in some cases. They all have their phones, and they're fixated on their phones, and they're not looking around at the room. You know, I've even seen people walking down the sidewalk texting. In fact, I was reading something the other day that some cities have passed laws saying it's illegal to walk and text because people have walked into poles and had to be hospitalized and things like that. But that's just one example of how our culture doesn't value this, doesn't give us an opportunity to slow down and empty the mind the way we did this morning. Focusing on the breath takes you to emptiness, to shunyata, ushin. And ushin is this purification. You know, it takes us to this place where thinking stops. It's like deconditioning the mind and preparing it to experience everything around us without the barrier of the self intervening. And, you know, I definitely think that many people feel a little bit dead all the time. You know, so if you are locked into the 24/7 lifestyle, and you're on the road early in the morning and you drive home at night, late at night. My neighbor, Eddie, is a wonderful guy, but he works in the city, and, you know, I'll come home from Zen and he's just coming home from his job in the city, driving home from Plainfield. And I feel sorry for him because, you know, his life is such a grind. He's a very nice man. But I do feel like, you know, if this keeps up, it might eventually make him very unhappy. And I'm sure he's already thinking about ways to liberate himself from this. But it's easy to get caught up in that we're just trying to get through the next thing, just trying to get through the next thing. And you might not even notice that the sun was shining. Right? Was it shining? Was it warm? Was it cold? So important to do this. And you begin to participate in this bigger life. And I would say that those people out west who live in the middle of the Tetons but don't think anything of it have not paid attention. And I think that we all create these artificial worlds in our heads. And as a culture, we create an artificial world. You know, it's certainly the case someday that people will be astonished, right, that, say, we didn't stop using plastic bags, right? I mean, because the damage they do is so extraordinary. But, you know, plastic bags are available at the grocery store, right? I mean, I myself have, like, 10 bags in my car, but even so, sometimes I won't have a bag. And I actually just buy another reusable bag. They're like a dollar, right? And I bring them home, and my wife says, why do you keep buying these bags? It's just like, I can't bring myself to buy one of those yellow plastic bags. Years ago, I was in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not, in the backcountry of Saudi Arabia. I was riding a train through Saudi Arabia. I was in the middle of this area. It's not really desert. It's hilly country with low acacia trees. And people there have terraced farming, like in East Asia. And the acacia trees are above the terraces. And I was coming in to this town, which is called Al-Baha, as evening was coming on, and I looked, and the trees had no leaves, but they had these white banners like Tibetan prayer flags. This was the middle of nowhere. And I thought, wow, those are like Tibetan prayer flags. And then when the train got closer, I looked at, they were plastic bags caught in the trees in Saudi Arabia. And those get into the water. They cause a lot of harm. So, you know, people will be astonished that we didn't respond to this, but it's part of the whole cultural system. You know, it's so easy to go to the store and put things in a plastic bag. And if you do it, I'm not criticizing you. You know, I do it too sometimes. But we live in a kind of collective dream, and you can't necessarily rely on what culture tells you is true or good. You know, I think it's very important to make your touchstone these experiences of selfless unification with the world around you, returning to the world around you. The wonderful Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh calls this interbeing. I'm not sure that even gets to it. It's like to disappear, to become one with the mountain, to become one with. This is, I think, the most wonderful thing in the world, to become one with. It's a kind of consciousness that I think would transform our world if only people knew how to get there, or could be persuaded to give something like Zazen a try. Anyway. The main subject of this koan is Matsu, ancestor horse. Matsu, ancestor Ma, ancestor horse. He was a great innovator in Buddhism. When Buddhism came to China, he was really one of the creators of what we call Chan, or Zen. You could say he was a great religious genius, if you wanted to put it that way. But he was somebody who was very skillful at teaching people how to become one with the world around them, how to selflessly become one with. And his teachings eventually had an enormous impact on Chinese Buddhism and on Zen, and we're all in his debt. So he's this great Zen teacher, and he's seriously, gravely ill. The great Zen master Ma Tzu was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. He said, "How are you doing these days?" The master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Many, many people, I have known a number of people who have died, and some of them were really haunted or troubled by the life they had led. This includes, I don't have to name names, but you know, definitely I know a number of people who died with a lot of regrets. You know, some of them had regrets because they hadn't accomplished what they set out to accomplish. So, you know, I had a friend in Seattle who was a writer, and he had these wonderful plans for his work. You know, he actually published a couple novels, and he was in the swing of all this, and he got sick, he got cancer, and he eventually died. And he was so unhappy that he hadn't managed to realize the vision he had for his life, you know? And I understand that completely, because I have things I want to do with my life. And you know, he was coming up on the end, and he was just so disappointed. You know, he didn't get to the, you know, we have in English, we have this word, this phrase, bucket list, this term bucket list. There are books at the bookstore that say 1,000 places or 100 places you should go to before you die, and you're actually supposed to, like, check them off, right, you know. He looked back at the writers he admired, and he wanted to say, I have left to the world all of these works. I had this vision of this trilogy of novels that, well, I will never write now. I know that my father-in-law also was, you know, he had worked very hard till he was 70, and he really wanted to travel. He had the bucket list, right? He had all these things he wanted to do, places he wanted to see. He'd put this off all his life. And then he began to develop renal failure in his mid-70s. And he eventually died, you know, unable to pursue his dreams, right? And again, he sort of was so unhappy that he wasn't going to be able to do the things he wanted to do. And there are people who do get it all done. You know, I understand that when Einstein died, you know, he had won the Nobel Prize, he was the greatest physicist, he said, well, that was good enough, or something like that. He died. Like, I've done it. But I think that's unusual. You know, I think most people have a sense of incompleteness or unfinished work to be done, right? And in some cases, people I've known have been sort of tormented by this. There was a guy in our community, our Zen community, the saddest example of this is there was a wonderful man who I think I can tell you his name. His name was Walter Miller. And he was one of the first members of our Zen Sangha in Seattle. And he was a gardener. And he came to every session, but he had a lot of physical pain sometimes. And, if the sit was going on too long, you could hear Walter clearing his throat. You know, so if the jiki jitsu was allowing the sit to run on, you could hear Walter go, and some of it might have just been nervousness, but I think he was kind of saying, signaling, like, ring the bell, you know. And it became a joke, right? We could hear, whenever we heard that in the Zendo, we all knew that was Walter, right, saying, ring the bell. And he was a dear friend of many people. He got melanoma, you know, from working outside. And it was inoperable melanoma. Very unhappy. But then, you know, when he was in hospice care, he completely changed. You know, people said he was the nicest person. Everybody, I went to see him once, and after he died, I talked to people there, and they said he was the most extraordinarily calm, pleasant person. And I think, you know, going through that experience made him You know, at some point you realize I'm not going to do the things I wanted to do with my life. I'm not going to get all the items on my bucket list, and my life is coming to its end. And, you know, you hate that for a while, and then you enter like a different space of consciousness where you suddenly realize, you know, just being one with this moment is everything. You know, just to be alive is so wonderful. You know, we have these absurd expectations of life, right? You know? So my friend had published several novels, and you know, he had this idea of writing this trilogy, and because he hadn't written the trilogy, he felt totally impoverished. But just being alive, you know, how lucky he was to write a couple novels that people, you know, maybe they're still reading them. And you know, just to get up in the morning, come to sit and walk outside. You know, when the small self drops away and you become one with the world, all of these concerns disappear as well. They go up like mist in the morning, right? You know, the sun cutting through the mist. They just dissolve. And you realize this is utterly, yes, in a certain frame of mind, this is terribly important. But in another frame of mind, this is utterly unimportant. When you become one with the life of the world, the bigger life, you know, in that moment, you have no birth and no death. You're just 100% here now. Yes, you know, the watch on your wrist is still ticking. It's still May the 25th. But in that moment, you experience a different way of living. It's like timeless presence. In Buddhism, that's called tat-atta. Or it's sometimes translated as, it's not a very nice word, but thusness. There is no time in the pure present of selfless cognition. And most people stumble onto those moments by accident. You know, they go to they go on a fishing trip, and they go to Cranberry Lake in the Adirondacks, and it takes their breath away, and for a while they're in a timeless now, and they don't worry about the promotion or anything. This is why people go up there. You know, so people do get there, you know. But, you know, we Zen people understand that the world humans live in is an imaginary world. It's a samsara. And that the world we experience when the self drops away and we become one with the things around us, that's reality, according to us, right? According to our point of view. So, you know, it's important not to spend too much of your life in the world of samsara and spend more of your life in this becoming one with mode of awareness. This is not to say that you shouldn't continue your work, right? If you're a doctor, please keep taking care of patients. And if you're a good doctor, you probably lie awake at night and think, did I say the right thing to my patient? If you're an environmentalist, you have every reason to tear your hair out. Please tear your hair out once in a while. Because if people don't fight, things won't get better. So people have to fight. You know, people have to try to make the world better. You have to try, or it won't get better. But on the other hand, you know, be careful not to get trapped in that mentality, you know, 24/7 of battle-ready mode, right? The world is very, very screwed up. But on the other hand, the world is absolutely perfect. And you can use your experience of, we say, big mind, and your ability to be absolutely here now, to nourish your small self as it goes through its trials and your tribulations. But you know, it's important to live your life, some of your life, maybe most of your life, in that timeless oneness with the world around you, and not spend all your time in that other world. When you're in that selfless oneness with the world around you, you know, time has no meaning, and you realize just to be alive is this amazing experience. It's the occasion for gratitude beyond all possibility of attainment. You know, I've talked about this many times before, but you know, one of the things that really got me into, maybe has, I've never forgotten, and was very influential in my Zen practice. There was a Roshi who came from Japan who was staying with Genki Roshi, who was dying of cancer. He also had cancer. And I thought maybe he had come to see Genki Roshi because he was having a hard time dealing with... It wasn't like that at all. He was an old friend of Genki Roshi's, and he was... When he would sit on the cushion, he would disappear. He was 100% outside of his small self. And you know, I would see him and Genki Roshi fooling around in the kitchen. You know, they had been monks together, young monks together. And they had so much love for each other. But, you know, this man had so much joy. You know, he was so alive, even though he was dying. And he had to go lie down sometime because he would get so sick. But he seemed, I don't think it was an act. He was absolutely untroubled by what was approaching. It wasn't stoic determination. He didn't live his life in the small self. He lived his life in that bigger mind. We have a birthday, and we have a cancellation date. But it's also true that we have no birth and no death. You know, when the Buddha described enlightenment, he called it the unborn and the deathless. Right? So, you know, yes, we have a biography, we have a birthplace, a birth date, but there's this other life we live when we sit on the cushion for a few hours and begin to live, and that is the unborn and the deathless. Even the greatest Zen masters will die, right? The Buddha died. When the Buddha was 80 years old, he died. If you read the sutras, he was falling apart. He was, you know, he said, "That's it. You know, I'm falling apart." And so even the Buddha died. Right? Matsu is dying. Matsu is dying. The great master Matsu was seriously ill. The chief priest of the temple came to pay his respects. These are like last respects, right? He asked, "How do you feel these days?" And the master said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." Well, there is a sutra that talks about a sun-faced Buddha who lives for like a kalpa. And there's a moon-faced Buddha who lives for a day and a night. It's a day. One lives for a kalpa. And a kalpa is like this enormous stretch of time, far beyond anything the life of the universe. They just revised the life of the universe. It turns out they've been saying the universe is about 13.4 years old, and now they've discovered it, 13.4 billion years old, and they just discovered it may be a billion years younger. So it might be, a billion, give or take a billion, right? A billion here, a billion there. You know, it all adds up. But a kalpa is much more than that. You know, it's like this enormous universes come and go while the kalpa is unfolding. So one Buddha lives for a kalpa, and one Buddha lives for a day and a night. And if you're in that state of mind, it doesn't make any difference. It's just 100% one with this. 100% one with this. Now, you know, it's always there. Buddha nature is always there. But, you know, we humans have to work hard to find what's always there. And we create imaginary structures that close us off from the world all the time. One of the teachers I trained with once said, human beings are like an oyster that secretes a shell to protect itself from the world, right? And that's definitely so. And the shell is made of our ideas, our preferences, and so on. It's actually the case that, you know, you can have this wonderful experience of being one with, and then that very same afternoon you start already secreting your shell again. So it's very important for humans to practice the way in an ongoing fashion, right? You're constantly working through your mental habits again, and getting back to that fundamental oneness, right? And we'll mess it all up again and get back to the cushion. That's life. That's a good life. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Secho's verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, compared with them, how pale the three sacred sovereigns, the five ancestral emperors. It should be the sun-faced Buddha, the moon-faced Buddha, compared with them, how pale Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, right? Who cares about those guys? Right. For 20 years, I have had fierce struggles descending into the dragon's cave for you. He's talking to his students. The hardship defies description. You clear-eyed monks don't make light of it. So he's saying we all have to work hard to get there, but please work hard and get there.